Does your morning toast or bagel taste more like cardboard than bread? Then you haven't tried America's number one organic bread, Dave's Killer Bread.
Dave's Killer Bread is made with the highest quality organic and non-GMO ingredients.
It's not just good for you, it tastes better than everything else.
Visit daveskillerbread.com to learn more and look for Dave's Killer Bread in the bread aisle of your local grocery store.
Hi, I'm Megan Segura.
And I'm Eric J. Mack.
And this is The Daily Dish, Bravo's official podcast. Sunday night, Bravo aired an important discussion about race inequality in America and what we can all do to move forward with hope.
Race in America, A Movement, Not a Moment, was hosted by E's Nina Parker and featured 12 Bravo celebrities who shared their perspective on race relations today, their personal experiences with racism, and what we can all do to create change.
A specific light was shed on how systemic racism affects the medical world. Dr. Britton Cole of Married to Medicine Los Angeles and Dr. Simone Whitmore and Dr. Eugene Harris III of Married to Medicine each described the inequality they see as doctors in the medical community and as patients themselves, and the work that needs to be done to increase representation in healthcare.
Plus, Bronwyn Wyndham Burke spoke out about what she is doing differently now as a mother to teach her children about racism and how her recent efforts to be an ally to the Black community have actually caused her to lose friendships in Orange County.
There was so much more that was discussed, so we're bringing you that episode in full.
Let's take a listen.
Most things with race in this country are very deep-seated.
A lot of people are saying, I don't see color, or I'm colorblind.
If you're colorblind, that means you don't even see me.
How can I not stand against racism?
I'm here now. What can I do?
That is what caused the world to take action.
This woman just started kicking my chair.
Someone thought that I was my kid's nanny.
What is that happening in the background?
There's a protest outside my window.
Hi, I'm Nina Parker, and I'd like for you to join me and a few of your favorite Bravo celebrities from across the country as we have a conversation about racism. After the horrific video of George Floyd's murder, Americans hit the streets demanding change. Now, this wasn't the first time videos like this have surfaced, nor was it the first time that Americans have protested the unfair treatment of Black people in this country. So, how can we make it the last time? The effects and the events of the past few months have sparked a new dialogue on race and equality. And tonight, we'll continue this important conversation and discuss how we can all be a part of the solution on Bravo's Real Talk about Race in America, A Movement, Not a Moment. So I'd like to welcome from the Real Housewives, Candy Burris, Todd Tucker, and Portia Williams from Atlanta, Garcelle Beauvais from Beverly Hills, Bronwyn Wyndham Burke from Orange County, Leah McSweeney from New York City, Giselle Bryant from Potomac, from Top Chef, Gregory Gourdet, and from the Married to Medicine franchise, we have Dr. Simone Whitmore, Toya Bush Harris, and Dr. Eugene Harris from Atlanta. And from Los Angeles, Dr. Britton Cole. I want to thank you all for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
We're going to jump right into this. Why do you think that these recent deaths really became the spark that made a lot of Americans take to the streets to protest?
My daughters and I saw the video, as everybody did, and that caused a visceral response out of pretty much the world. But my kids, more importantly, were immediately like, Mommy, we've got to do something about this. They wanted to hit the streets. They couldn't sit anymore in the house and not have their voices heard. And I was right there with them. I'm like, let's go.
Like, when I watched that video, I literally wanted to turn it off. And something told me, no, you have to watch it. You have to hear everything that George is crying out. You have to hear him yell for his mother, plead for his life, tell them that he can't breathe. Look at the look on the policeman's face. Notice that nobody was moving, even though the people who were filming were pleading for his life. All of that created a moment that would hit anybody's heart who watched it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what was so horrifying about it is how cavalier this cop was. The fact that he could have his hands in his pocket while he killed another human being was just, I mean, I've never seen anything like it.
And it was so upfront. It was such a long period of time for you to have to sit and watch. If you turned away, it almost felt like you were turning your face against racism. I know that's how it was for me. That is the type of passion, hurt, and pain that we had to see upfront during a pandemic to get us out of the house.
Yeah, I think because we're stuck in this pandemic, I think what we were experiencing right now is like a powder keg going on.
I think for me with our family, it was the first time in our lives we've all been together. And I've been with my older children and younger children, and we had the time to watch it as a family and then talk about it. And we're so busy most of the time rushing around our own lives that it's been very easy to tune things out that didn't affect us. And we couldn't tune this out. And we were forced to take a moment and say, what just happened? Why didn't I notice this before?
Yeah.
I think, you know, George Floyd's situation was kind of like this generation's Rodney King, but it ended with death.
You know, the younger generation, they're not playing any games. And I feel like they really are the spark for everyone to just say, you know, no.
Dr. Simone, have your sons joined any of the protests?
My younger son, Michael, requested to go protesting before the Spelman Morehouse kids were snatched out of their car. And I refused. I refused to let him go down. I had a safety concern for my black male children in America. And the bottom line is, I felt, my personal opinion was that police are angrier than normal. And if there was an encounter with the police in any shape, form, or fashion, it wasn't going to go well for him or them.
And that's a very valid concern, to be honest with you. My children, they had the same concern.
My oldest has a little airsoft gun. Well, it's not a little airsoft gun. It's a pretty big gun that he likes to shoot in the backyard. It's not real, but it looks like an assault rifle. And I don't let him go outside with it without me because there's a golf course behind our house. And I don't want somebody to say, there's a big black man in the back of his house with an assault rifle,
even though
he's barely 4 foot.
I had somebody say to me the other day, you must be glad that your younger boys are, you know, not dark. And I really took offense to that because it was like, it's the way the world is that people see us. Right, exactly. That's the reality. And that's what really hurt.
You know, we talk about, you know, light and versus dark, or what's considered passing, you know, all of these conversations that really come from systemic racism. So just to clarify, it means that since slavery, American laws and beliefs haven't really changed. Black people have been denied housing, passed over for promotions, refused the right to vote, and treated like second-class citizens.
So I'm a black woman who clearly doesn't look obviously black, right? I had this one incident, which was kind of eye-opening. I was talking to this white guy, and he said, why are you talking like that? And I was like, well, what are you talking about? Talking like what? And he was like, you know, like that. Like, why are you still talking black? I mean, when there's no black people, we stop talking like that. Why are you still doing that? And at that moment, I was just like, because I'm black. That's when, like, my eyes really opened wide and I saw the world for what it was.
So, Leah, you've actually been out protesting with the Black Lives Matter movement for several years now. Why did you feel like this was a cause that you needed to join?
I think it really started during when Eric Garner was murdered in Staten Island and the first Black Lives Matter. I believe those were when the first protests started. There was no way that I couldn't join it. Having so many black women as role models for me that I loved and looked up to, and just feeling very immersed in black culture and accepted by black culture, how can I be a part of that and then not stand with black issues and against racism?
Gregory, being both a black man and a member of the LGBTQ community, do you feel like you're a double target?
Oh, I mean, definitely. You know, I mean, I'm extremely grateful that, you know, some good laws came into effect this year protecting, you know, LGBTQ community, in workplaces. But just as something gets given, something gets taken away. And a big part of Black Lives Matter has been, all Black Lives Matter. And we're specifically talking about the gay community, the trans community. We're talking about different gender identities and making sure that all those voices are 100% heard. Because when we talk about Blacks being targeted, when you talk about a Black trans person, the target rate is extremely high. And already this year, we've seen more murders and deaths of trans people, in the first few months of this year than all of last year altogether. So it's hard because there are a lot of different opinions and we just need to keep moving forward because this is extremely important.
What is that happening in the background?
There's a protest outside my window.
Where do you live?
I live in Portland, Oregon.
They're protesting outside your window literally right now. Coming up,
my white neighbors, all of them were white, would ask me, am I the dog walker? it almost was comical.
I'm a Black man who wants to have a Black life with my Black family and live free.
It sounds like systemic racism creates different ways that society views Black people. Candy, do you agree that there is certain rules for Black people in society?
Oh, definitely. Anything about the hair, we've all seen where some of the kids have been, not being able to be at school with braids or with dreadlocks. That is a problem. But I was going to bring up the fact, even with our names, we are discriminated against. It's sad that some of us have to think, okay, I don't know if I'm going to get this job right if I put my name on the application. Todd, tell them how your mom felt when she named you as a kid.
So when I grew up with friends named Rasheem, Hassan, Kareem. Like, those were like my boys. And my name was Todd. And I asked my mom one day, I was like, why did you name me Todd? Like, that's not a Black name. And she was like, because I wanted to give you an opportunity to get your foot in the door. I didn't want them to judge you before you showed up.
How about that?
I've had so many different experiences in my life. My parents immigrated here in the 60s from Haiti. They definitely experienced racism from the minute they got here. Not only being Black, but also having heavy accents. Even at an early age, I was taught, it was really important that I looked a certain way. I tucked my shirt in, I had to have a certain haircut and be prim and proper. So it's always been this thing that I find myself in a very, very Black neighborhood growing up, extremely Haitian American, Caribbean American, and then finding myself in these white spaces through education and through careers and having to navigate both.
Leah, you said that you had a friend who said that they had to dress differently in a professional environment. Like, they couldn't just wear the casual clothes because they would be viewed differently.
Yes, I was having a discussion with a friend of mine named Sharifa, who she came on my podcast as a guest. And I think that day I was wearing leggings and sneakers and a dad hat and like a crop sweatshirt. And she's always dressed very professionally, always like so well put together. And she was like, God, you look great like that. I wish I could dress like that, but people won't take me seriously and they're going to think I'm ghetto. And then I thought about it and I completely had this epiphany about privilege. And it's like, oh, I'm a white chick, I can wear this and no one's going to be like, oh, she's ghetto. But if Sharifa had worn that, like, she can't. She has to dress very professionally to be taken seriously all the time, whereas maybe I don't have to.
Garcelle, do you agree that there is a certain image that you have to portray to be perceived or taken seriously?
Absolutely. This has been going on for years. And to piggyback on what Leah said, I mean, look at braids. I mean, for the longest time, a professional woman, a lawyer, couldn't go into the office with, braids because that was considered sort of ghetto. I know for me, when I was first auditioning for TV shows, when I came to LA, and people would say, she's not Black enough. And I was like, well, what's Black enough?
So Giselle, have you seen that echoed with your friends and family as well, being judged before you even walk in the door?
Absolutely. A couple things. One, when I was naming my children, I actually thought about that because that was ingrained in me. Like, you have to give your children a chance. If you name your children three syllables, then a white person's not going to be able to pronounce it. And when they see their name on a resume, they're not going to get a call back. Mm-hmm. That played into me naming my children. And it shouldn't. It shouldn't matter what I name my kids.
Sure.
And a Black man wearing a hoodie and a white man wearing a hoodie are two different things. Black man wearing a hoodie can get you killed in this country.
Giselle, that's actually such a good thing to talk about, because too often law enforcement will see us as a danger and not as a person.
Right.
Toya, I want to talk to you because you actually had a car accident a few years ago and said that you didn't feel like you were treated fairly by the police. Can you tell us what happened?
Me and my sons, we were at a stop sign and we were hit head-on by a pickup truck. He was actually a really nice white guy, the individual that hit us. And when the police officer came, he didn't come over to the car. He went to the pickup truck. And he asked him if he was okay. He said, you should ask if they're okay, because she has two small children and they're in the car. Wow. He showed no support whatsoever to us.
And I think that's it's interesting when you use the word systemic. You brought a whole people who had communities, families, kingdoms to this country to make them basically a utility. And so when a police officer, who the original police force, before they were police officers, they were slave catchers. They were there to protect property. We were property. And so when police come, even now, there's a white man and then there's a family, you know, this black with two small children, that white man, we have to protect his property. So what did this black woman and these children do to this man?
Simply put, the American system was built for white people. And that means that white people are the standard and given the benefits of the system, whether or not the person realizes it. They are considered more trustworthy. Their bad actions can often be justified, and more likely than not, they're given the benefit of the doubt when a situation involves a black person. Garcelle, let me ask you this. The flip side of white privilege is that black people are often suspect. Have you ever had an experience where you felt like you were being misjudged because you're black?
Oh, absolutely. I remember being in New York City and walking into a store, and it was a high-end store. And I'm just looking around, and then I said to the salesperson, I said, hey, can I see that? I think it was a bracelet over there. And she's like, oh, you know, that's really our high-end section. And I was like, okay, can I see it? And she looked at me for a minute and paused, and then felt like, okay, she has to show it to me. And she kind of like slowly walked over, opened the case, gave it to me, but just like really suspect, like, you can't afford this. Like, why are you even wanting to see that? And so I went back and forth. I was like, do I buy it just to show her, or do I really even like it? So I actually had to think about it.
Garcelle, I totally feel you on that. The real annoying thing is when not only do they look at you like you can't afford it, but they may escort you over to the sales rack instead.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, most of the time I prefer to not buy from the person that is obviously showing discrimination. But, you know, I agree with Garcelle. Sometimes you feel like, I just want to show her that I can because I can. You know what I mean? But at the same time, it's like you don't want to give that person your business because, you know, it just feels like I'm awarding you for treating me badly.
It's a tricky thing.
Mm-hmm.
100%. I think the opposite side of that is just when you automatically go into a space as a black person and you already feel that you're going to have to overgive or overspend because you automatically feel like that stereotype is already just happening. Right. These are the things that go through our head because we believe that we are looked down to, thought less of the second you walk into that space because you are black.
I feel like it's almost like an instinct that you get, especially as a black person in a public space, that you can kind of sense immediately when someone has some type of feeling about you being in that space. Do you agree, Portia?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually had a condo in Buckhead, and every time I would walk my dog, it happened at least about five times to me that when I was in the hallway, my white neighbors, all of them were white, would ask me, am I the dog walker? It almost was comical. Like, oh my gosh, like how many times do I have to tell you I'm not the dog walker? Right. Then on another floor, I stopped at the gym and they had a little play area for kids. And I was asked, was I a nanny and for my services? And it was just, and it just became the norm. And it was just something that I had to deal with in living in that building.
Up next,
You know what? I feel like white folks, not all of them, but I still feel like white folks feel like they're black folks' supervisors. They feel like they're the boss of all black people. I'm checking in to make sure you're doing what you're supposed to do.
With the privilege of whiteness comes the possibility of abuse. White men and women who abuse their white privilege are now known to be called Karen. Candy, I want to talk to you about this Karen situation, because a Karen thinks that being white means that they get to decide what people of color get to do, how they act. You got to answer their questions. Have you ever been confronted by a Karen?
Yes. Not that long ago, when I was on tour with my group members, we were in first class on the plane and my seat was let back, but I was asleep and it was an older white woman sitting behind me. And as the plane was starting to come down, and, you know, everybody's normally, you know, letting their seats up, I was still asleep. The stewardess had not, you know, woke me up or anything. This woman just started kicking the back of my chair, like, hard. She was like, "You're endangering my life. And, you know, drama. You need to let your seat it's up." So and I was like, if I would have really reacted, you know, then I would have been the one that was
You
wrong.
Could have got kicked off the plane if you would have
exactly.
reacted.
Exactly.
Because black folks aren't allowed to have natural reactions. That's why.
Dr. Yeah. Eugene, have you ever had an experience where someone threatened to call the police on you?
On me, no. I did have a small incident with a Karen. Kind of. I was swimming laps at the pool, and this lady was like, "You're splashing me." I said, "Ma'am, I'm swimming." I said, "I can move over to a different lane." She was like, "You're just splashing me." I said, "Ma'am, I'm swimming. I'm not splashing you." And then this other guy, he was like doing laps. He was actually a white guy. He was like, "Ma'am, we're all just swimming laps."
Yeah.
You know, but I was the only black person in that pool. And I even, you know, was laughing at Candy's story. But then I always have to remind myself, when we talk about the Karen, quote unquote, we have to remember Emmett Till died because of a Karen. So the Karen thing and the Kens or whatever you want to call them, it's serious. I mean, it's very scary.
Now, in San Francisco, the city council is actually debating the Karen Act to make false racially motivated calls to 911 illegal, like the one that Amy Cooper made about the bird watcher Christian Cooper after he asked her to put her dog on a leash.
Please call the cops.
I'm going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life.
Please tell them whatever you like.
Now, rather than walking away, Amy told Christian, "I'm going to call the cops and tell them an African-American man is threatening my life." And by saying the term African-American, she used it almost as a symbol of danger.
Yeah, that was a violent act. That was an act of violence against that man.
Absolutely.
You know what? I feel like white folks, not all of them, but I still feel like white folks feel like they're black folks' supervisors. They feel like they're the boss of all black people. I'm your supervisor. I'm checking in to make sure you're doing what you're supposed to do. And it's that sense of entitlement that's been part of our history, where any old person on the street, you don't have to be a police officer, you don't have to be a teacher or a doctor, you can be any old civilian, just walk up to a black person because I'm your supervisor and I'm in charge of you. And they feel like they can do that. So until you hold them accountable for their actions, making things like this hate crimes and prosecutable by law, they will continue to do it. I can't change somebody who's racist. I can't change their minds, but I can change that behavior.
Right.
And by changing that behavior, you start to see change within the community. So if you know that you're gonna pull out a phone and call the police and have a false claim on a black person, and you are, and going into that, you know you will be prosecuted. You will right. lose your job, mm-hmm. lose your license for whatever it is, go to prison, get fined. It will change your behavior.
Yeah.
And it starts with legislation.
Yes, we need more law. We need San Francisco to do it. We need all communities around the country to have that kind of act. When I saw that Amy Cooper, there was charges being brought against her, that sends a signal to everybody. Like, look, 911 is not a weapon at your leisure because you don't like what a black person is doing.
This really does feel like we're in the midst of a revolution. There are truly real changes that are happening, and also people who seem resistant to those changes.
I think it just goes back to, historically, bad behavior has been accepted. We're in a call-out culture now where it's placed on blast. But until pretty recently, you could do whatever you want and get away with it, and no one was going to know.
And I think like the most dangerous Karen of all is a white man or woman that is taking the law into their own hands. If we talk about the men who confronted Ahmaud Arbery while he was jogging, or Trayvon Martin, who was just walking back from a convenience store, it turns bad really quickly. Candy, both of these encounters ended in death. Do you feel safer now that the country is more openly talking about these situations?
Absolutely not. I don't feel safer at all right now. I feel like there are things that are happening in this country right now that still have me at a high level of concern. I feel like there are people out there who are, you know, doing attacks in secret. You know, I mean, I feel like, you know, now that we've seen all these young black people out there that are just all of a sudden hanging on trees, and they're saying that, oh no, it wasn't foul play or anything like that.
Suicide.
Todd, do you agree? Do you agree with Candy, Todd?
I do. And I kind of told her that I thought, you know, with all the protests that was happening, that some of this stuff was going to occur. And I'm from New York, but living in the South is a little different. You can make a left turn. You're on a dirt road that's dark, and it can get really scary really quick. So we just try to make sure that practice, you know, safety measures of, you know, traveling home a certain way, make a couple extra turns to make sure nobody's following you, you know, just to be precautious.
I had a friend who had been speaking out about, you know, civil rights and, you know, the rights of black people and publicly. This is recent. And their house got shot up.
What?
Wow. But they didn't want to say it publicly. They didn't want to talk about it on TV. The neighbors were saying that it was a group of white people that did it. But I just definitely feel like there are retaliation things that are happening in the country right now that people are not talking about, or they don't necessarily want to bring attention to. But there's definitely a reason to still be afraid.
Absolutely. I feel like now there's a permission. Before, people sort of felt like they did it behind, you know, closed doors. But now people feel like we can do whatever.
We'll be right back with more in a moment.
It is systemic. We shouldn't be 5-7% of doctors in the country.
Medical school is half-sighted. So when you're looking in those books and we look at rashes, what color is the skin?
White.
It's all white
all
rashes.
All of it is white.
I want to talk about something that hits home with a lot of the people here today, and I want to talk about the medical profession because it's not immune to systemic racism either. Recently in New York City, the statue of Dr. James Marion Sims, the father of gynecology, was actually taken down once people learned that he had experimented on enslaved women without anesthesia because he believed that they didn't feel pain. Dr. Eugene, this belief that still persists today, that black people, and I've heard this from people say, oh, well, black women don't feel pain the same way. You said that you've actually witnessed this with different treatment between black and white patients, correct?
Right. So, you know, the health disparities, just like most things with race in this country, are very deep seated. You know, you spoke about, you know, I don't even want to call him Dr. Sims, to be honest with you. But, you know, he invented the speculum. There's a lot of things that he invented that, you know, you still use right now in modern gynecology. But he did have, he experimented on black women. He did surgeries without anesthesia. And it was a belief that the slaves that he was experimenting on were not human. Therefore, he could do what he wanted. It's almost like in high school, you may dissect a frog.
Right.
I think he probably had the mindset that there was no difference. Now, fast forward to the 21st century, pound for pound, white patients get treated as though they have more pain than black patients.
Wow. Right. With my first miscarriage, I was actually sent home about 3 or 4 different times telling them that I was in pain and I felt like I was going to have a miscarriage. And it just goes back to, you know, doctors feeling like black women have this serious threshold for pain. And you have to manage pain for patients, and because that can trigger other things in the body. And so I really do feel like the pain management around that time, I ended up having fibroids, and that's what was causing it, is what caused so much stress on my body that I ended up having a miscarriage.
You know what? There have been numerous accounts where we'll have patients coming up from the ER to the operating room, and I'll overhear them say, oh, this patient is in sickle cell crisis, but he's a drug seeker. So, you know, he only got this much narcotic. Now, okay. Flip that and say, we have a patient with cystic fibrosis, okay? They come in, no one says they're drug seeking. No one says, oh, he's a frequent flyer. He's in here all the time. They give him what he needs to make him comfortable. So this is real. The disparities are huge, not to mention the disparities within the medical community itself, within the healthcare staff. We have our own battles we're fighting amongst other doctors, right? Because the white doctors versus the black doctors. There's no support in the system for us as physicians. That's why most of these academic institutions don't have black physicians to take care of the black community, because they end up shifting them out, because they get pushed out, because it's a hostile environment. It's hostile for the patient as well as for the physicians.
And it leads to a lot of distrust within our population with medical providers. You know, when you hear stories like the Tuskegee experiment, that gets passed on generation by generation. Your family members say, hey, don't trust that doctor.
Right.
And so you're less willing to go seek medical care.
Part of the problem is, you know, a lot of black people, Latino people, they typically go to community hospitals, community clinics, and that's where they get their health care. Why? Because they see doctors that look like them. They speak their language. So they feel more comfortable there because they know once they go to the big house, and that's what we call like the major academic institutions, they'll get lost. There's no one who speaks their language, no one who understands them, and no one who really even cares about them, right? So they get slower treatment. They get minimal treatment sometimes. They don't get what they need. So they're in these communities. They don't have enough staff members. They have subpar equipment. So they don't even have what they need in these communities.
My husband went to a physician himself, and the bedside manner was not there when he went to a white physician.
I had a older white physician who I really felt like he had his finger out and he was just kind of pointing at me like, you need to do this and well, you're going to die. And he said he was going to put me on a medication, but he said it in a threatening manner. He's like, I ought to put you on this medication. I was like, I don't need it. I'm a physician also. But I just recently went to, you know, one of my colleagues and I loved everything he said. I'm taking my medicine. And
right. And he even said he made him feel uncomfortable because he was like, take your shirt off, you know, and he was just the way he talked to him.
Right.
I see African-American patients who are just distrustful of the medical system. I know that they are hypertensive, the blood pressure is too high, they need to be on medication to control it. They're not trusting of the medication. They don't want to take it. They think that this is something they can control themselves without medication. And they believe sometimes that even I, as an African-American physician, talking to them are not giving them the best information.
Well, Simone, do you feel like you protest every day while you're at work?
We deal with racism at the hospital every day. Our patients, we as physicians. One of the most important points I want to make, because here in Atlanta, we are so spoiled that there are so many African American physicians in various specialties, but in the U.S., there are only 7% of physicians Wow. across this country. It's a small number when you look up that we make up 12% of the population. So at a minimum,
right,
the African Americans should make up 12% of the physician community.
I think it is systemic. It starts with, you know, better access to medical education. Simone's right. We shouldn't be 5 to 7% of doctors in the country. And then when black doctors, you know, we make it, we are able to help black patients and we're able to help our white physician counterparts relate better to black patients as well. You know, we have to have a seat at the table to be able to enact change.
I do agree with that, but I also think that the education we get in medical school is half-sided. So, for instance, let's just say we're looking at rashes on a person's body. Like, Dr. Eugene, Dr. Simone, you can attest to this. When you're looking in those books and we look at rashes, what color is the skin that has that rash?
All white rashes.
Right?
All of it.
So a black person comes That's in true. With a rash and you're like, well, I don't know what that is. True. I ain't never seen that before.
Right.
So the education right. itself within medical school isn't up to snuff. I mean, let's talk about patients that come in a sickle cell crisis. They are in pain. They can die from that pain. They need pain medication, blood transfusion, IV fluids, whatever it is. But let's start really focusing on the differences within the races, because there are differences.
Dr. Simone, what's your advice for a Black person when they go to a hospital and how to interact with doctors when they feel like they're not being heard?
I always remind patients as Google and get as much information for yourself as you can. Ask as many questions with your healthcare providers as you can, because racism, sometimes it's blatant, but also racism can be very subtle in the healthcare system. And I like to remind patients to do their own due diligence. If you feel like you're talking to a doctor, you're asking questions, the doctor's too busy, doesn't have time for you, can't answer your questions, won't give you eye-to-eye contact, those are all good reasons to seek care elsewhere. Patients will often say to me, would you do this treatment if this were you? And
that's a great question.
That is something we also need to be asking our white counterparts when we see them, is if this were your wife, if this were you, would you take this medical care that you're suggesting for me?
Impactful. Thank you so much for sharing that. Coming up, have you faced any backlash in the allyship and speaking out?
Oh, absolutely. I have in my own town. I've lost friendships. I've lost 3 really close friends.
Keep my brother's name ringing. Keep my brother's name ringing.
Bronwyn, when someone says Black Lives Matter, immediately what I hear is all lives matter. I hear that a lot. Yes. Why do you think the Black Lives Matter movement scares so many white people?
I think that what they're hearing is only Black Lives Matter, and they're not taking the message, which is, of course, all lives matter. Of course, we're not saying that all lives don't matter, but what we're saying is we have to focus on the fact that Black lives matter right now.
It's almost insulting because Blacks are at such a disadvantage in almost every aspect. And it is insulting to have someone telling me that all lives matter. Of course, all lives matter. We are all God's children. But until we deal with the inequities that Black people have been dealt with since the arrival to this country, nothing's going to be fair.
Dr. Britton, do you agree?
Well, I mean, to go back to what Bronwyn said, when she said that, I guess, you know, when white folks say all lives matter, it's because they don't understand or something to that effect. But I think that's just giving them an excuse or a pass to get away with that behavior. They know what it means. They know it doesn't mean only Black lives matter, because we would have said only Black lives matter. Clearly they know it, because if all lives matter, why weren't you chanting all lives matter before we started saying Black lives matter? Nobody was saying that slogan. Nobody cared about all lives then. So they know it. They just don't want to give up what they consider their privilege.
Todd, do you agree with that? Do you agree that it's just more of a retaliatory statement than a statement that really is trying to be humanitarian?
I think it's a fear. I think it's a fear of being uncomfortable, you know. Right now, Black Lives Matter, and it's time for everyone to understand that. That is time right now to deal with what's happening to Black America. White America, it's been white America. It's still white America. But right now, we have to even the playing field. And Black people need help right now.
It's like we've constantly seen Black people being treated unfairly. And so the point is, if all lives matter and Black people are part of the all, then that cannot exist until Black lives matter.
Leah, I know that you said that you had a cast member who said it. What was your response to them?
So, look, I think that there are some white people who truly have no idea, which is a problem in itself, because ignorance, even though ignorance isn't as bad as being just a straight up racist, it's still really bad. And then some people say all lives matter as a retaliation. I don't know how you can live in a city like New York City with, there's so many Black people in New York City. First of all, there's so many different ethnicities in New York City, and not realize what a troubling statement that is.
Have you faced any backlash with people being upset that you're supporting Black Lives Matter?
Oh, no. No way. Not at all. I mean, maybe some random commenters, but nobody from my inner circle or my family or friends, you know, nobody, whatever, they're all for it.
You know, I live in Portland, Oregon, which is a very, very white town, but it's also an extremely liberal town, an extremely active town politically. And we have blacks and whites and all POC kind of fighting for the same causes. But, you know, I think if anything comes out of this is a lot of small things leading to big changes. And I think we can see a lot of small changes today from how white allies interact with us, like people making strong efforts to diversify their workspaces, diversify their leadership. And maybe things will be really different in 20 years.
Bronwyn, you have actually said that being quietly complacent isn't an option anymore. Have you faced any backlash in the allyship and speaking out?
Oh, absolutely. I have in my own town. You know, I come from a very conservative, very Republican, very antiquated area. You know, Newport Beach is 90% white. And I've lost friendships. I've lost three really close friends because they thought that my way of advocating and trying to be an ally wasn't correct. They thought I should be nicer. And that we needed to, you know, be polite, that you can't protest and you can't mark up buildings. That's not the right way to do things. And my response being, we don't get to decide the right way to do anything. This isn't about us. Our job is to support, not speak over. Our job is to listen and learn right now. This isn't about us. This isn't about white people and how we feel right now. This is me saying, I'm sorry that it took me so long to get here, but I'm here now. What can I do? And then just taking every step I can with me. And also, you know, I have a lot of kids, so a lot bringing my children along on the journey with me.
Candy and Todd, let me ask you, are you shocked to hear someone can lose, you know, their three closest friends to just saying Black Lives Matter? Is that a shock to you?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, right now, with her speaking up, I can just tell by the comments that I see on social media, if any of her friends feel that way, I would not be shocked at all that they are turning against her and that she's being an ally, that she's being supportive, that she's speaking out. It's like, you know, it's a lot of people out there who, even after all that we've seen, they are still saying that racism doesn't exist.
You know what, Candy? What you're saying is real true. Like, I feel like to the privileged, equality feels like oppression, right? So to people who have always had, they've been entitled to certain, you know, luxuries in this country, if they have to share that with someone else, they feel like it's going to take away from them and they'll have less. If there's equality, they feel like, oh no, then you're gonna take away all my good stuff and I don't want that. And so to the privileged, equality feels like oppression, and that's the problem.
Right.
I think it's also really hard for a lot of the people in my social circle to say, maybe I am racist. You know, you can't fix a problem until you admit it exists. And I've often discovered that when I bring this up and say, look, this is what we have been dealing with our whole lives. We have been taught this way of thinking. We all have racism somewhere inside of us. Just saying we don't isn't going to fix the problem. Let's talk about it. Let's admit that we have a problem. And then we can move forward. And that's been really hard for a lot of people.
Right.
Coming up.
And speaking with some of my white counterparts now, they're like, well, slavery is over. I didn't own slaves. So why do I have to apologize for anything that happened in the past?
Welcome back. You know, I hear a lot of people are saying things like, you know, I don't see color or I'm colorblind. I hear that a lot. Especially here living in Los Angeles, it's people kind of wear that with a badge of honor, but I am skeptical about that. Can
That's
we actually
problematic.
Be colorblind?
If you're colorblind, you're essentially saying I'm invisible. If you're colorblind, that means you don't even see me. So how can you empathize with me? How can you relate to me if you don't see color? Like, to me, that's a slap in the face. Don't tell me you don't see color. I mean, so what do you see?
You have a certain percentage of people who say, white people who say, I don't see color, who actually don't see color, and they don't, and that is how they're raised. They never were a part of any type of racial being racist in their mentality. And then you have another side who's saying, I don't see color, who is just so living in their white privilege that they don't want to recognize that there's an issue in America. My thing is that whatever side that you're on, it's no longer okay for you to continue to just state that you don't see color.
I think, you know, there is some that are being malicious, but I think some just don't want to be blamed for past transgressions that they had no part of. You know, I think speaking with some of my white counterparts now, they're like, well, slavery is over. I didn't own slaves, so why do I have to apologize for anything that happened in the past? We're like, well, black people aren't asking you to apologize for anything. We're just wanting you to know that you have a white privilege, and there are things that happened 300-400 years ago that you benefited from, whether you see it or not. And I just want you to see that there are things that I didn't get, that I'm fighting a battle and climbing a hill that you didn't have to climb up.
And I think, you know, we were talking about this a little bit earlier, Bronwyn, because you were talking about being in Newport Beach and it being a predominantly white area, and not only white, but very conservative.
Very.
Do you see a shift in the conversations that you're having?
I have, but I think it's very slow going. And I wanted to say, I feel like a lot of people in this town, that was sort of the goal, was not to see color. And when she stated it so beautifully, when you don't see color, you don't feel me, you know, that was like, that's it. I didn't have the words to express what I knew, but I knew that was it. And so I think for me, it was taking conversations with my children, my older children, to really realize that what we've been taught in our community isn't okay, but it is changing. And like Candy said earlier, it is coming from the younger generation. Of course we see color. You know, we understand that, you know, the color of your skin is a part of who you are. And when you say, I don't see color, it shuts the door to the conversation.
I don't look like most of the people that are in my family, my friends. And so I've kind of lived, you know, the first part of my life kind of ashamed of the color of my skin, right? Because I wanted to fit in. I wanted to look like my family and friends. And so once I entered the workforce, that is when I started to, I guess, come into contact with white people, as strange as that may sound. It was very interesting to hear the conversations that people would have about black people, not knowing that I myself am black. And so I became the fly on the wall. I was like a spy. The funny thing is, so I had this one argument slash debate with this white woman. And mm-hmm. she was throwing out every stereotype you can possibly think of. And I couldn't believe she was saying this out loud. She was saying stuff like, you know, black women use abortion as birth control and, you know, black people are lazy. And our debate got so heated that I stood up and I was like pointing my hand and like, how are you? You know, we going back and forth. And at no point in time did she ever say she felt threatened, that I was too aggressive. And it was because I looked just like her, or so she thought. And when I hear experiences from my colleagues who are obviously black, as I call it, they have told me stories where people, they'll get into a debate and all of a sudden it becomes you and an administrator telling you, well, you can't have all that, you know, you can't talk like that. You can't be aggressive. And you start to have those conversations as opposed to the, let's talk about the racism that I'm experiencing conversation within this workplace.
Giselle, how have you dealt with that with your children?
It's been an issue. You know, when my children were younger, they thought that I was white. And so when they were at school, they would tell their friends that their mom is white. And they were saying white as in a color, not a race. So once I figured that out, because they told me, I was highly offended and bothered because it showed me that they didn't understand. And it showed me that they were confused. When they were younger and we would go out, it was a major confusion as to why is this woman who looks white with these brown children, are they her kids? And that's offensive.
I got
to me. That makes me feel like, first of all, yes, these are my kids and it's none of your business what color they are, but that is an immediate sign to me that you have some racist issues because you are questioning the color of my children.
I actually had that. I had someone thought that I was my kid's nanny. And she said something to me in Spanish. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't speak Spanish. And she said, you'd make more money if you spoke Spanish. And I thought, well, Telemundo pay a lot as an actress. I'm thinking, as an actress, maybe I need to speak Spanish. And And when she realized, one of my boys came up to me and they were smaller and he said, "Mommy," and she completely turned bright red and ran off because she realized that they were actually my kids. So, I mean, wow. you see it in all different ways, you know, almost on a daily basis, you know?
This is such an important conversation. And, you know, I'm really glad that we're having it because some of the things that you guys are saying we've heard before, but, you know, hearing from your own personal experiences really make things hit home. We'll continue our discussion in just a moment.
My twins were in the sixth grade and had the N-word written on their desk with a black Sharpie. Mm. You know, I want to burn down the school.
I want to talk about another form of racism. In America, biases are placed on black children. That negative judgment denies them opportunity and kindness that are afforded to a white child. Giselle, can you talk a little bit about your children? Because I know that there was some type of issue that they were confronted with in school that was racist. Can you tell us what happened?
Absolutely. My twins were in the sixth grade and came to school and had the N-word written on their desk with a black Sharpie. So there's no confusion. That's how the person felt.
Oh, my God.
And for them to come home and tell me that, you know, I want to burn down the school. I don't even know how to address that because, you know, here we are, we think we've made so much progress and we haven't. But racism is still here. It's not going anywhere. And I'm setting my kids up for failure if I don't teach them that they won't be treated the same because they're not going to be treated the same. And yeah. As a mom, you know, raising teenagers, I feel so strongly about every mother going into that principal's office and that administrator's office and saying, "Hey, where are the black teachers here at this school?" My children have said to me over and over again, "We have never been taught by a black teacher." That matters.
So I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, obviously, which is in the South. And I certainly was blessed to have some black teachers in my lifetime on elementary, high school. But I got the bulk of black history during my time at Spelman College. So even though in my younger years, I didn't get all of the black history, I had guidance from black people who loved and wanted to see me succeed.
That really does translate the schools, the teachers, the doctors. It's all kind of embedded in systemic racism.
In talking about systemic racism, I think it's important to realize that not just white people have it, black folks have it too. Right. Because it's so ingrained. So the whole idea of this country, at its inception, education has gotten us to where we are today. We've always been taught that white man created everything, they invented everything, they built everything. So if you are growing up believing that the white man has created everything, all those who don't fit that picture start to believe they are inferior, right? Now take that a step beyond and say, okay, actually, black people, y'all came from kings and queens. Y'all came from tribal leaders. Y'all came from medicinal makers. If you tell them that glory about themselves and their history, what do you think that would do to their psyche then? I think that starts to change, right? So what you have to do is re-educate the American system. You have to start telling the truth. All the stuff that they're learning in these schools have to be ripped out. You can't discover a country that's already got people living in it.
Right. And I think that there are so many educators now that realize how important it is to learn about black people like Dr. Daniel Hale Williams, who performed the first successful open heart surgery in the world, or that three black female mathematicians made it possible for the first American to launch into space.
I think in general, education is usually the first place to begin because people don't know as much as other people, or they don't know their history of America, right? Because black history is American history. I educate my children, but that doesn't mean that my white counterparts are doing the same. I am not a politician. Right. I am not an educator, but I feel like the educational system needs to be changed.
Oh, absolutely. I learned about Tulsa and Rosewood 2 weeks ago. I'd never learned those in my history book. So I think we're kind of working against a system that we're, you know, 400 years behind.
Black History Month shouldn't just be 1 month out of a year, right? How many times have we said it? It should be 12 months out of a year. Because if children start to see equality in their history, like Black people have contributed just as much, if not more, than white people, then they'll see themselves as equal. If all you do is propagate this idea that there's a superior race within our history, that's what people will believe.
I mean, I think it has a huge impact. We actually just changed our children's school this year because they were going to a school where we felt like the diversity wasn't there. And they weren't seeing it with the teachers. They weren't seeing it with the principals. They weren't seeing it within the classroom. And so they weren't having the conversations, you know, about the culture. We're very open with our children about what's going on in society right now. I mean, I talk to my children about racism. My son, who's 8 years old, he asked me today, he was like, what's racism? You know, why does it exist? He asked me specifically, why do white people not like Black people? And I was very clear when I responded and I said, not all white people don't like Black people. Right. And I don't ever want you to say that because you have white friends and that's not what we're teaching you. And I don't want you to go to school and be taught that either.
Are you having those similar conversations, Garcelle, with your sons?
Oh, absolutely. We've had these conversations since they were three. You know, I'm Black, their dad's white. We've had these conversations from the beginning, because I didn't want somebody to pollute their opinion of who they are. So we've been having these conversations for a long time. As a matter of fact, my older son, Oliver, who's, when you see him, he's all Black, right? He was in school and the principal was Black. And she had a teacher come in and said, I have these two kids. One of them said the N-word, and this was in first grade. The two kids come into the office and she looks up and they're both white. So she's like, she's taken aback by who used the N-word. So what had happened was they were in the playground riding those big wheels, and one of them called the other one an N-word because he had heard it in his parents' car and thought that meant a bad driver.
Wow.
Oh my God.
So we've always had these conversations, and I got pulled over a couple of months ago, and my son Jax was in the back seat, and I was so happy that he actually was there to witness how I, you know, treated the officer. I was respectful. I had my hands on 10 and 2. I said, I'm going to reach for my wallet and all these things that, you know, we've talked about in the past. But the fact that he actually got to witness me behaving a certain way, that if he ever gets pulled over, he knows what to do. I actually thought that it was a blessing that that happened and he could see it.
Coming up,
where do we start? I think it's my white friends being able to call me and say, if I say this, does that offend you?
I'm still very uncomfortable at times talking about it. This is not my comfort zone.
So let's talk about what actions we can take to help put an end to racism in all its forms. Let me start with you, Bronwyn. How are you teaching and encouraging your kids to become the voice of change?
One of the things that I started with my older children is family book club. So the first book we read was Raising White Kids, and then I sat down with them and we talked it through. And I had to sort of admit some of the things that I did wrong with them when I was raising them. And what I would do different, or what I am doing different now with my younger kids. I think the more we read and the more we discuss, the easier it gets. Because I'm still very uncomfortable at times talking about it. This is not my comfort zone. And I'm hoping that they can get more comfortable with it. Talking about it, getting out there, and learning from people that know more than me.
Right.
There are a lot of people who are in that same position that are just trying to learn. Dr. Britton, do you have any thoughts as to where we can start to really try to end this divide?
I think we should push Black folks to go into medicine, law, politics, law enforcement. I mean, I know now there's this push for STEM, for science and research, but I think we need to push our Black kids into areas where change can really make a difference. Like, politicians make all the laws. We need more Black folks infiltrating that system. We need more Black physicians to take care of our Black community and our white community. We need to change law enforcement in general. Yeah.
Can I say something about that? We glorify too much being a, you know, a baller, a rapper.
Exactly.
Nothing wrong with that. But I'm saying we make those so much more glamorous and amazing that the kids aren't wanting to go to law school and be a doctor and all that, because all the other things are shinier and, you know, you can make a lot of money really quickly. And I feel like that's part of it. We have to sort of make the doctors cool. We got to make the lawyers cool. And I think that's a way to start. But also, when you were saying, Nina, about where do we start? I think it's having a conversation. I think it's white people, like my white friends, being able to call me and say, if I say this, does that offend you? So we also have to be open to have the conversation that may be uncomfortable for us, may be uncomfortable for them, but where they can say, if I say African-American, does that bother you? I personally prefer black. But,
I prefer black people.
I think we have to be able to be comfortable to have those awkward conversations so that we can learn from them.
I do agree with you, Garcelle, and I think that uncomfortable conversations are where change starts. And I know that there are many ways to protest and make your voice heard. And a lot of you guys have platforms where you really reach millions of people every single day.
And that's what's so great about our social media. I mean, and to the point where when we were at home and we were talking about it, I kind of got offended by some of my friends to the point where I was sitting there waiting. Like, who's not going to post? Who's not going to hold themselves accountable?
You know, if you're someone that posts all the time and then you went silent during what's been going on, then I'm completely suspect. Well, I'm also conflicted because social media, even though it is important, I think it's more important how you act in your everyday life rather than what you're doing on social media, even though it's also important to use your platform, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think that's a debate, right? Because there are people who think, look, if you have a platform, you should be using it. Even if you have 100 followers, you should be speaking out about this. Bronwyn, have you seen a change by you posting on social media, by you being active?
I mean, personally, I gained and lost a lot of followers on social media. I think about 30,000. So I think the demographics changed. You know, I went from being a very passive housewife because I didn't want to rock the boat to saying, you know what? I can't be quiet anymore. This is who I am, like it or not.
Gregory, you've talked about how allies might be able to help the movement by keeping a spotlight on these issues. What did you mean by that?
I've definitely seen a lot of my white friends and white allies really look at themselves and really dig into their white privilege. And, you know, just from a social media standpoint, you know, it's been great to see people post, like, you know, the numbers of the courts and the police districts to posting, you know, where to call and where to donate for Brianna. This is like actual work that is actually important.
I completely agree with you. When we return,
this election season is do or die for us. We cannot act like, oh, it's going to be okay because somebody else is going to vote for us. No, you have to vote.
There are a lot of Americans that are protesting, using social media to push back against hatred and racism. But there's also another powerful place where many of us can make a change, and that's at the ballot box. Giselle, you've talked about amplifying Black voices through voting, but many Black Americans are taking voting for granted. What do you think is the danger of that?
This election season is do or die for us. We cannot take it for granted. We cannot act like, oh, it's going to be okay because somebody else is going to vote for us. No, you have to get involved and you have to vote. That means that you need to know where that is that you're supposed to be going to vote. Obviously, you need to be registered. And you need to know what you're voting for.
Yeah, exactly.
I got a mail-in ballot for the primary. And on the back of the ballot were all the judges in my area. And I was able to research all of these judges because those are the people that you're going to see locally if something were to go wrong. You know, if I were to get pulled over and I have to go see a judge, well, now I know their names. And now I know how they stand. And now I know because I voted for them. And it's so key and it's so important.
I just personally feel like our local government is really what affect us as a community and business firsthand. So regardless of if you're a business owner and you're an African American, you have to go to the city to get anything done. But our initial Black mayor in Maynard Jackson back in 1973, he was the one who started initiating changes in our law and policy that now a certain percentage of all government contracts from the city has to go to people of color. A lot of us have benefited from that. And that is made that way because of our local government.
Right.
Helped make it that way, put policy in. There are people now who feel that, you know, we should not necessarily have those laws still in place. They feel like, well, things are equal now. You know, those things aren't as important. Why are those laws still in place? Well, what they don't understand is things aren't equal, you know, when laws have to be there to make you do something, then it's not equal. I mean, a lot of these big companies wouldn't, you know, give a portion of their business to a minority business owner if they didn't have to. So those things have to be there.
Right. And I love that you're connecting all of these dots, Candy, because I think there are so many people who don't realize how important these local elections are.
I've noticed a lot of women that I know who are very smart, very educated, still vote the way their husbands or fathers do. So I'm working with some women that I have a lot of respect for that are very knowledgeable. And we're going to try to just educate the women in our neighborhood to vote for themselves and to vote on issues that are important to them.
It's just really about knowing who you are voting for and being a very intelligent voter, so that way you can be an effective voter. Now we as the people who are educated can hold them accountable. It's the same way you do any employee who don't do nothing when you turn your back. Keep your eye on them and you need to measure it so that way it can get improved.
Right. Right.
I'm
right.
So happy because I feel like y'all keeping your eye on everybody.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and using your platforms and doing something like this that really helps just continue the message and keep the momentum going. So I want to thank everyone who participated in our discussion. And I hope that we've learned that to talk openly about racism isn't something scary or something to be avoided. Things left in the dark, they fester. They grow. And shining a light on old beliefs and wrongful behavior is the only way out. Now, we must do this together. To keep this dialogue going, please go to bravotv.com, and together, we can all beat racism.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you, everybody.
And remember, watching Bravo isn't a guilty pleasure.
It's self-care.
Guys, let's keep the conversation going. We want to talk to you all week long. You can find us on Instagram at Bravo Daily Dish.
And on Twitter at Bravo TV. Just don't forget to use the hashtag Bravo Daily Dish.
Or reach out to us personally. I'm everywhere at Meg Segura.
And I'm everywhere at Eric J. Mack. That's E-R-I-K.
And if you're on Facebook, join the Daily Dish Facebook group.
You can post about what you're watching, your favorite shows, who's your favorite housewife, ask a question, start some drama. There's a lot of good stuff in there, so check it out.
You can also learn more about the podcast at bravotv.com.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Looking fine, and I got my girls with me. With the boys at the table getting tipsy, miss me, kiss.